Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Three Down Nation podcast. I'm Justin Dunk, joined by Jean Auge, otherwise known as John Hodge, the newest and handsomest bald man alive, we'll call you this week, Hodge. J.C. Abbott, just pissing off one Rider fan at a time. What do you have to say for yourself, Abbott?
What did I do this time? I haven't talked about the Riders this week, have I? Yet?
Your picks,
I'm sure I'll Rider get into it.
Hate your picks, JC. They think you had no faith in Shea Patterson.
Well, I don't have any faith
in Shea. He's a franchise guy now.
I have a lot of faith in their Canadian receivers. I don't have much faith in Shea Patterson, but they're bailing him out right now. He's getting all the he's handling it well. He's making the throws he needs to. He's not making a lot of mistakes. I'll get him that. I don't think he's a player that you win because of. He might be a guy that you can win with.
You wouldn't have heard this, Mr. Abbott, but somebody called into the CKRM postgame show and specifically said, Dunk, you have to tell Abbott he is terrible at picking football games. And I was like, okay, I'll give it to him for sure.
I want to say thank you for saying I'm the handsomest bald man in the world. Because that's including like Jason Statham and some very, very famous, good-looking people. But you don't have to just say...
I said the newest handsome bald man, not the most handsome.
Oh, well, thanks for bursting my bubble. You don't have to hate JC's picks because they're just objectively bad. Like, you don't have to hate. There's no hatred. Hey, I was ahead of you straight up going into this week, huh?
I'm not talking about straight up. I'm talking about against the spread.
Oh, nah, straight up is all that matters.
No, because your straight up picks aren't that good either, bro. Not, at least not right now. I tabulated
better than yours.
I tabulated the results on Sunday night after the Sunday nighter between Calgary and BC. And you're not going to like where your against the spread picks are at right now. It's really bad.
Yeah, this last week was a rough one. This last week was a rough one. I'll grant you that. But we have bounce backs every week.
You are the Edmonton Elks of CFL pickers.
Oh, boy.
You are.
Harsh words.
Yeah, but warranted. It's really bad. You'll have to pull your socks out.
Well, okay, I'll be better on Thursday, I promise.
Though I actually appreciate your ineptitude because mine aren't very good, but they're much better than yours. So no one's coming after me. Everyone's coming after you. And I picked the Riders to win. So ain't nobody in the province of Saskatchewan hating on Hodge. They like me this week. They hate JC.
Rider Nation, you can't say Hodge is a homer. All right, let's go. Today we're discussing a tough week for CFL officials.
Wally Buono pushing for United States expansion.
Adam Big Hill smashing Shea Patterson on the final play of Winnipeg's loss to Saskatchewan.
The Alouettes not ruling out quarterback Cody Fajardo.
And the Edmonton Elks coaching change. But first,
Edmonton QB McLeod Bethel-Thompson ripped the CFL again after his team's loss to the Ottawa Redblacks, as the Elks suffered three major injuries on a short week, calling it a travesty and adding, quote, "It's easy to sit in the ivory tower and plan some schedule and think that they'll be just fine. These are human lives that you're dealing with," close quote. The comments came 3 weeks after MBT accused the league of having a lack of leadership regarding their schedule making, for which he was fined an undisclosed amount. JC, were Bethel Thompson's comments fair, or is he just a whiner?
He's just a whiner here. And I get that short weeks are difficult for players, and two things can be true at once, right? Like, it's going to feel terrible to play on a short week. Your body is probably very sore. You're banged up. You don't want to have to go out there. And when you're playing against the same team, yeah, it feels a little bit pointless. But right now, there is no compelling evidence that short weeks, like they have in the CFL, are dramatically more dangerous than players for anything else. There are a couple of notable studies looking at the Thursday night games in the NFL over the last couple of years, and the amount of injuries found that there's no statistically meaningful increase in injuries on Thursday night games after teams have played on Sundays. That's a shorter turnaround than what teams get in a short week in the CFL. It's an inevitability when you've got nine teams and you're looking to have a schedule that works for television and everyone gets a chance to watch all of the games, that sometimes somebody's going to draw the short straw. And frankly, it is ridiculous for McLeod Bethel Thompson to go out there on his soapbox and claim that a schedule that has more balanced rest than ever before in the CFL and three bye weeks is somehow extremely dangerous for the players. Guys are going to get hurt in football. It absolutely sucks. I hate to see it happen. But of those injuries in that game, the serious ones, the ones that he believed could be, quote, career ending, one of them, only one of them was non-contact. Everything else was just simply a football play, something that you get hurt on regardless of the timing, regardless of when you were playing. He's way off base here and frankly grasping at straws to explain why his team is so utterly terrible.
Where's the CFL's ivory tower?
It's wherever they sent those nachos a few years ago on Skip the Dishes.
That's amazing. Man, JC, I agree with you 110%. McLeod Bethel-Thompson, this is what you signed up for. You knew the schedule was going to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday games in the summer. And then obviously when the NFL starts and plays on Thursdays and Sundays, the games are, I believe all of them, if not most of them, are going to be Friday, Saturday. This is what you signed up for. You didn't have to sign that contract. It's pro football. I bet MBT would be singing a much different tune, as they say, if the Elks were undefeated versus being winless. Perhaps he should focus more on watching film or actually leading his teams to victories in these games instead of blowing them in the fourth quarter, as the Elks have done many times this season. I'm not saying all of those losses were on MBT's shoulders, but I think really this is just a factor of the Elks' tensions running high there. And the expectations for McLeod Bethel-Thompson coming into this franchise were to lead them to the playoffs. And unless there is an unbelievable turnaround, I do not see that happening. And guys, the only turnaround that could give them a possibility to make the playoffs is putting MBT on the bench and putting Trey Ford as a starter. Let's call it what it is, okay? And I just don't understand what Randy Ambrosio did. Did he pee in MBT's Wheaties or what? Because this is not the first time or the second time. It's at least the third time that MBT has put the commissioner directly in his crosshairs. Yeah, fourth times, like not even twice is a trend. Four times is a trend. Like, I don't get it, man. focus on football. I like guys who are passionate and speak their mind, but to do it again on this topic that's clearly not going to change, and the change for the CFL to have one game Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, except for last week, by the way, there was no Thursday game, I was told, due to the CBA and stadium availability, but you knew what you were signing up for. Don't come back up here then and play football, because we don't hear other guys going on two epic rants about this. I know the fine is only $250 and it's probably worth it to do it from a pocketbook standpoint, but I don't think ranting and raving like this is going to get it changed, even if that was a possibility.
Well, we don't know what he was fined. We know that the kickers were fined $250 for speaking out about the microchips. It's possible it's the same amount. I don't know. I'm going to take the opposite side of this, at least to some extent. I think everything you guys said was valid. I think that tensions are 100% boiling over in Edmonton. I think McLeod, it's pretty obvious he went to Edmonton for the paycheck, right? He's making a lot of money to be there. That being said, I appreciate that he is using his platform to speak honestly, because we do in the media complain, right, when people don't say anything interesting or they talk in cliches. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to hate on somebody who says interesting stuff. And McLeod Bethel-Thompson says something interesting every time he opens his mouth. The other thing I want to say is his partner, Chinaka Hodge, no relation to me, by the way, is a high-up showrunner for Marvel Television and Disney Plus. So between what McLeod himself has made and what his partner makes, he is in a financial situation that almost no other players in the league are, where he can just speak his mind freely and pay the fines, and who cares, because he's going to be just fine either way from a financial standpoint. So I appreciate him using that platform and that position that he's in to maybe voice complaints that other players have, and we do know that other players don't like playing on these short weeks, even if maybe they're not saying it publicly for fear of being fined, right? McLeod Bethel-Thompson is making $500,000 this year. It's easy to speak out when you're making that compared to somebody who's, say, making 80K and worried about potentially, you know, not being on the roster next week. It's not like the Elks are cutting McLeod Bethel-Thompson, though maybe if they want to go the Trey Ford route, as Dunk wants them to, they will. Who knows? But for now, I appreciate McLeod Bethel-Thompson speaking his truth. Do I think he's 100% on point here? No. But I will say this. For me, the injury issue is one thing, and I want the empirical data from not just the league, but hopefully the Players Association, because, JC, you've done a great job of presenting what the NFL has. To me, it's an entertainment issue. This game was awful. This game was one of the worst football games I've ever seen in my life. And the game that these same two teams played at Commonwealth Stadium the week prior was great. That was a fantastic matchup in week six. Week seven, they go to Ottawa 5 days later. That was a snooze fest. It was awful. The best part of me watching that game was the cuddles I had on the couch with my dog. Nothing in that game was interesting. Nothing was fun. Aww. Nothing was exciting. It was awful. And I almost fell asleep, which was a problem because I had to cover the Bomber game right afterwards. So the entertainment factor is the bigger issue for me. If two teams are playing on a short week, they're tired, they're exhausted, they haven't had enough time to install a full game plan, you're not going to get entertaining games. And if you're not getting entertaining games, that is going to hurt your product tremendously for very obvious reasons. People don't want to tune in to a snooze fest. They want to tune into high-flying, big action football. We did not get that this week. We got a snooze fest. It stunk out the joint.
I think you've got a bit of a point there, Hodge, in terms of the entertainment value, particularly because it was the same two teams playing. I think if you've got Edmonton on a short week playing somebody else and one team's a little tired and banged up and the other team is refreshed and they can put up some offensive points, then all of a sudden you've got a different dynamic, maybe a competitive disadvantage, which the league was trying to avoid, but the potential for some big plays as a result. When both teams are tired and familiar with each other and just basing it off the film from last week, we got what we saw in Ottawa, which was two defenses that had figured out the opposing offense, boring gameplay, not a lot of innovation, not a lot of pop and sizzle to that matchup. So I absolutely hear you there. And I also hear you on the sense that we don't want McLeod Bethel-Thompson to just shut up and play football, right? I love when he goes off. I love every time he makes those comments, because I get to write about it and we get to drive traffic to the site and drive interest to the CFL and all of those things. But it's also true that when he does that, it is optically a bad look for his football team, which he is the leader of, because it looks like sour grapes after you've lost yet another game. If the records were different, if he had been more successful in that football game, then maybe we're not as critical of these comments, and perhaps that's not fair. But
he probably doesn't even make them if they win, is my guess.
He might not. Yeah. We can't speak for him. Maybe he just feels passionately about this topic regardless, right? That is entirely possible. But if he makes those comments and he played well and the Elks won, I don't think we're like, well, look at that sore loser. Because they played poorly and they lost for the sixth straight game, he looks like a poor loser. It looks like a team that is in disarray and coming apart at the seams and looking for excuses. And that's not going to help them going into next week when they've got a nice 9-day rest before their game on Sunday.
My thought is, if you're going to complain about something, I almost swore there, then have a plan with it. You know, a lot of times people just want to yell at the clouds like the old man on his front porch. But the next step, I guess, I would like to see, because I do appreciate McLeod Bethel-Thompson being willing to take the fine hit to his pocketbook that he knows is coming and speak his mind. It's definitely great on a number of fronts, but give us a plan. What would McLeod Bethel-Thompson's schedule look like?
Absolutely.
I feel like that could be a conversation that could help publicly, but more importantly, behind the scenes, to have a schedule that he feels like it's not going to be the one that he exactly wants, but that he feels like is something that would be more beneficial for the players.
And I don't mean to jump in front of you, Hodge, but I think that's incredibly valid, because we talked about this is the fourth time that he's put the commissioner and the league in his crosshairs. Well, the first time that I can recall, well, actually it was probably the second time, because he went off about Garrett Marino first, but was at Grey Cup in Regina before the Argos won, when he lambasted the commissioner at the podium for, you know, a terrible marketing of the league, all these criticisms in terms of how things were handled and not getting it in front of viewers and not marketing it properly. Well, some of the changes that they've done in order to do that is to put the games on Thursdays and go Thursday through Sunday in the summer to be able to get more viewership and drive TV ratings and market the games and get it in front of people. So if you're not happy with that change, MBT, you need to come up with an alternative. You can't be, you know, attacking the commissioner on both ends here. You can't criticize him for not doing anything to improve the product and its marketing and then challenge him for how he did it, which has clearly been successful based on the viewership upticks and everything that we've seen over the last year. So he's got to present some sort of alternative. He can't just be criticizing for the sake of criticizing.
Don't you think Randy Ambrosi would just love to put McLeod Bethel-Thompson in the sleeper hold and just let him have a nice rest so he doesn't say anything mean anymore? Like, what do you think those conversations are like when Randy Ambrosi sees McLeod Bethel-Thompson next?
I wonder who Randy would have the more adverse reaction to, McLeod or Arash Madani? That's my question.
I would say that Randy Ambrosi deals with Arash Madani professionally, even though he does throw some high heat at him from time to time. But McLeod Bethel-Thompson has done it, you know, way more often lately than anybody else.
That's true.
Well,
and for clarity, Arash is a friend of the show. We know Arash. We like Arash. I'm not taking a shot at Arash. I know Arash.
What does an offensive lineman do when his quarterback pisses him off? He just casually misses a block every now and again, lets him get land-based. Maybe there's a reason.
That makes me think of a story, and I learned this a long time ago. Yeah, it was such a stupid thing, but I'll say it. I just learned you never upset an offensive lineman, but more so you never surprise them. And I feel like in this instance, MBT is surprising Randy Ambrosi, a former offensive lineman, with his comments, because I'll tell a story real quick. I was at one of my former buddies' summer cottages up in Port Dover, and he used to just throw me around like you guys know, a little wiener. And I thought, you know, I'm going to get him. Here he is in position where I think I can get him. I jump on his back and I pin him and I'm like, yeah, I got you, bro. 1, 2, 3, ding, ding, ding. He throws me off like a wet blanket or something. And I hit a dresser that had a mirror on it that wasn't attached to the wall. Oh. The mirror fell down and split my hand open. This was after my playing career at the University of Guelph, thank goodness. But I thought after that, I'm never messing around with anybody bigger than me physically, okay? Never again.
Well, maybe there's a reason why the Elks have the most short weeks in the CFL. It could just be that Ambrosio is not blocking for MBT anymore.
They got two more. They've done two. They've got two more. They got the worst. That's true.
CFL officials had a rough week. Not quite as rough as Randy Ambrosi and MBT, but they made some questionable calls and were littering the field with flags during Sunday's game between BC and Calgary, calling 23, count them, 23 penalties. Hodge, does the three-down league have an officiating problem?
I don't think they do. Quick correction. The Elks have one more short week. My apologies. But they do still have the most of the CFL. That is correct. Look, the CFL officials had a bad week this past week. And I am somebody who considers himself a staunch supporter of CFL officials. First off, officiating is an extremely hard job to do in any league. And when I watch other professional leagues, some of which have substantially higher budgets and viewership than the CFL, I see officials making mistakes all the time. So I want to make it clear that I'm not sitting here saying that the CFL officials stink on a week-to-week basis. That's not true. That being said, the best game of the week was the BC-Calgary game, and I thought it was ruined to some extent by some of these penalties, some of which were complete nonsense. The worst offender was the holding penalty on Tyler Packer when BC was way back in their own territory. He was engaged with the D lineman. It was a totally clean rep, and then Suk Chung, which is his job, by the way, from right guard, came in and blasted the D lineman, knocking him over. It was a beautiful O-line rep. It was not a hold, right? Holding usually happens when you've lost the rep and then you panic and grab a guy. That is not at all what happened. It was a clean O-line rep. And because that took place while Vernon Adams Jr. was in goal, the Calgary Stampeders were awarded a safety. What did they win that game by again? Was it 1 point? How much is a safety worth again? Ooh, all right, a safety is worth 2 points. So I'm not saying that the refs cost them the game. I was wondering, yeah, it's dose, by the way. Anyway.
Well, they won it by 1 point, which is uno.
They won it by one, and a safety is worth dose. Two. That's correct.
You guys got to keep up here.
A little delayed reaction with your
It might have been an internet connection thing, too. I don't know. But it just
had to break out the Spanish-English diction.
No, don't make excuses. Yeah, I was a little behind.
But there was also a really terrible PI call on Bentley Sanders when he appeared to be in perfectly fine spot.
That was
right?
Awful, man.
Working
Steve
against
Dickinson
Justin
was
McKinnis.
So mad. I thought he was going to throw the flag at the official after.
Well, if anybody's going to bean the official with a flag, it's probably Dave Dickinson, one of the most accurate passers in CFL history. But look, if you miss what is obviously a penalty, at least then you're letting the players play and decide things. But the penalties that drove me nuts this past week, there were a number of them in the Winnipeg-Saskatchewan game, too. There was a complete phantom holding call on Kyrie Wilson. There was a nonsense illegal contact penalty on Deontay Williams that was like 50 yards away from the play. And the worst, I thought, was the 30-yard pass interference penalty on Tyrell Ford, which was a complete joke near the end of the game.
That was pretty bad.
It was awful. And I give full credit, by the way, to Glenn Suter and to Dustin Nielsen, who on the broadcast were telling it like it is, right? I think there are times in professional sports where broadcasters are expected to carry water for the league or not be overly critical or try to calm fans who might be heated about stuff. Kudos to them for being honest about it. I don't think this is an epidemic. I don't think this has to be a long-term problem. I just think if I'm Darren Hackwood, who runs the officiating for the CFL, and again, I think does a very good job, generally speaking, you got to get on the horn this week and you got to say, guys, we cannot be littering the field with flags left, right, and center. If you're not absolutely sure it's a penalty, keep it in your pocket and let the guys play. Because coming into this week, we only had 14.7 penalties per game in the CFL, which is the lowest number, I looked it up, since 1974. Like, we are living in an era where penalties are few and far between relative to the history of the league. 23 in that one game was awful. The players have to play cleaner. If it's an obvious penalty, you obviously got to throw the flag. I'm not saying that the refs shouldn't call anything, but they have to be more selective because so many of these ticky-tack calls that don't really stand up when you watch it on replay, it ruins the entertainment value of the game, and it cheapens things, and it starts affecting scores. I still think Calgary deserved to win. I still think Saskatchewan deserved to win, but my goodness, keep the flag in your pocket. This game is not about you. If it's a sure thing, throw it. If it's a maybe, keep it. Don't throw it. No one pays to watch flags. They pay to watch plays.
All angry officials. John Hodges' email is.
I don't care.
Phone is.
I don't care. By the way, if there's one thing that I could change, we're going to talk about commissioner for a day a little bit in the show later on. There's one thing I could change. Why can't we talk to the officials after games? If it's a terrible call, like a player throws a terrible interception, they talk to the media. A coach makes an absolutely asinine decision, they talk to the media. The official throws a complete garbage nonsense flag that affects the outcome of the game, and they get to go home. How is that fair to anybody? So that's a change I would make.
Men, when we leave the house, it's phone, wallet, keys, how's my hair look? But if you're experiencing hair loss, you may not be so confident when you step outside your door. It's time to get that confidence back and restore your hair with Hims. No man wants to lose his hair, but for men, it's actually quite common. And now with Hims, the solution is simple. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who got their flow back. Men, real talk. The only thing worse than losing your hair is waiting forever for it to grow back. That's why you need Hims, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple, with doctor-trusted treatment options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. They offer personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatment options, so you can find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online. Just answer a few questions and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to your door. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, so if you feel like you're losing a part of yourself with your hair loss, get Hims and get your confidence back. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I think you illustrated the problem with this week beautifully, Hodge, and I agree with you that refereeing in the CFL is typically very good, and certainly I hate talking about the officials because I've been an official in other sports. I know how difficult it is to be one. Oh, yeah, I was a water polo referee for many years. I absolutely hated it. Because
why would anybody subject themselves to being an official? Like, I just can't understand. Umpire,
because it paid very well, Doug. And I was in high school, and it was one of the better gigs I could get for weekend work. But it was terrible, and I hated it because there was so much pressure. It's so difficult to do. Mistakes are inevitably going to happen, and people are not very
perfect.
Yeah, people aren't very forgiving of that. So typically, I take a very relaxed stance when it comes to missed calls and officials and things like that. But this game between BC and Calgary, there was some egregious ones that you highlighted there, Hodge. And to me, it's less so the mistake made by the officials on the field, but why the command center was not doing anything, right? Like that PI call by Bentley Sanders, which should not have been PI, was challenged. And I get that the letter of the law is that there has to be enough evidence to overturn, but it was clear from anyone watching those replays that wasn't PI. That call should have absolutely been overturned by the command center in 2 seconds. Instead, it stood on the field. That shouldn't have happened. And the holding call in the end zone, that was not a hold by any stretch of the imagination. There was no torquing of the defender to the ground. Packer didn't hold him or pin him to the turf. He was able to get up cleanly. That's 2 points. That's a scoring play. Aren't scoring plays supposed to be automatically reviewed in this league? I know that you don't want coaches to be able to challenge holding because it happens on every single play and it's a very nuanced call, but surely in a situation that egregious, when there are points scored, the command center, which steps in on every single other scoring play, should be able to look at that and say, no, that's not a hold. That play shouldn't have happened, right? Take it away, put the points back, give BC another shot. And I'm not saying that because I think that's why the Lions lost the game. It proved to be the difference. But as we said, like, the Sanders call was terrible. Calgary got their fair share of bad flags thrown against them. But that is a difference-making play in a football game that the eye in the sky should not be silent on.
You know what? You guys have done so much bashing the officials this episode that I'm going to get you both I heart officials buttons. You're going to have to wear them on the podcast in the future, okay?
I'm okay with that. They have a difficult job. Don't get me wrong. I'm extremely grateful.
Super tough job.
Yeah, for officials. I mean, even at the high school level, when I'm coaching, I'm not a guy who lips off at the officials. I hate when coaches do that because they're out there giving of their time, doing
work. You've never lipped at the official ever?
I have never yelled at an official. I've questioned a couple calls calmly. I haven't always agreed, but I do not yell at the officials. I think that is terrible, especially given the fact that we have so many challenges scheduling games and getting things on the right days because we don't have enough officials, right? They're often covering multiple games in a day, you know, several games over the course of a weekend just so that we're able to do things. There are not enough officials in this country. We don't want to be ripping on them, but we also can't ignore when there are obvious mistakes.
Yeah, we're going to tell it like it is on the show. I think generally the officials do well. They did badly this week, period.
There was some absolutely atrocious officiating back when I played at the University of Guelph. Some of it goes against you. Some of it goes the other way. But, you know, it takes me back to the 2007 Yates Cup. Yeah, roll your eyes, fellas. When one of my buddies, Grant McDonald, defensive end, got a penalty for playing football. The ball was on the ground. There was a fumble. He recovered it inside, I think it was the 10 or 5-yard line of the Western Mustangs. Mm. And somehow this guy gets a penalty for just playing football, knocking somebody else out the way and jumping on the ball. And the Mustangs get the ball at midfield because of this crazy set of circumstances that happen and completely changes the entire momentum. So, you know, I'm not saying I love officials or that they're perfect. I just want to balance this out a little bit. But you guys went so fast and so hard at the CFL officials this week that I feel like they just might need a hug. So is there any official out there that, you know, wants to have a nice time and relax and forget about people making this outside noise about the last week? Come find me. I'll give you a hug. We can chill and relax.
Well, and if you're going to get us buttons that say we love officials, we'll get you a button that says I played football at the University of Guelph. How else would people know?
I was going to say, Dunk.
You never bring it up. How else would they know?
Do you want to go on the record with what you feel about the University of Western, since you've talked about how you feel about the officials?
That's well documented.
It's also called it's called Western University, not the University of Western.
Well, it used to be University of Western.
Oh, it used to be the University of Western.
It used to be. Now it's just Western, which makes total sense, you considering it's east of half the country.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It's West Ontario, kind of, I guess. But it makes me think it's West Southern Ontario. It should be the University of Western Southern Ontario.
Or Southwest Ontario.
Or just basically Detroit. Just call it that. Mind you, I guess Windsor would have an issue with that.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it makes me think of, I was talking to Mark Mueller before the Riders game. And he starts up with this story. He's like, do you know what the best moment ever in the history of Canadian university football was? And I was like, did I miss something that happened in the Canada West when he was playing? Like, I'm racking my brain. And he goes, you know, there was this quarterback at Guelph that scored the touchdown in this big homecoming game. And I was like, bro, you are such a you're hilarious. Anyway.
And that's why Dunk isn't allowed to swear on the podcast. Fun fact.
Yeah, I almost did it, but I refrained myself, fellas. I've learned, okay? Hopefully these officials learn from these terrible flags this week.
Legendary CFL head coach Wally Buono, who was honored by the Calgary Stampeders this past week, told TSN's Farhan Lalji if he was commissioner for a day, the first thing he would do is pursue United States expansion. Dunk, did that surprise you? And do you think that expansion south of the border is a smart idea?
It surprised me a little bit coming from Wally Buono, just because I feel like we haven't heard him speak on this topic in the past, although I wasn't around, you know, for a lot of his earlier coaching career. But as for the second question, if I think it's a smart idea, possibly. That said, though, fellas, I feel like before we start talking about U.S. expansion, we should at least have 10 teams in Canada that are sustainable. Halifax should have been done a long time ago. And this leads me into another conversation that I think is related, because a lot of people look at the Canadian Football League and they go, well, that's not a real league. They only have 9 teams. So I said to a couple people recently who have brought this up in talking about wanting a 10th team or trying to get to potentially 12, which I think is an absolute pipe dream at this point, that if you look at the population of Canada, okay, let's call it 40 million, because I think it's just under 40 million. Hodge, is that right? You're the stat boy here.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Okay, so that's the size of the state of California, essentially, okay? The U.S. population is well over 300 million, you know, so if you do some kind of quick back-of-the-napkin math, so to speak, that would mean that per capita, the NFL should have, I think the way I worked it out was like 90 teams or something like that. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to equate it to the same per capita as Canada, if you guys kind of catch my drift here. I'm not a mathematician, so don't take these numbers at face value. But if you look at it that way, I think you gain a whole new perspective for the CFL. And part of the reason why we have 9 teams, and, you know, dare I say, it's been a struggle to get that 10th team. I still think that 10th team could have been in Halifax, you know, at least a few years ago, if not long before. But it gives you a little insight into that, right? There are more fans per capita in Canada that watch the NFL compared to the United States. Like, these numbers are out there and readily available. So, you know, it surprises me when people kind of look at the CFL and they're like, well, it's not real league. They only have nine teams. Like, look at the per capita basis to be able to support these teams. Think of the NFL having 90 teams in just the United States. Like, that would be insane. But that is absolutely the equal if we're talking about the CFL. So to get back more to the question, I do think it would be possible in some markets. St. Louis is obvious as one that could thrive. They've shown it through the XFL especially and this new incarnation. What are they calling it? The UFL now?
Yeah, that's correct. UFL.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Stat Boy. And I think there might be some other markets, you know, closer to the border that could be great. And I can't even believe I'm going to say this, but Brendan McGuire really thinks a team would work in and around New York City, and I just can't see it for the life of me. It's unbelievable. The concept is somewhat decent. I think he wants to revive the, was it the New York Generals in the United States Football League?
I think it was the New Jersey Generals.
We're also just back in the USFL.
He was the owner and then killed the entire league.
There you go. So he wants to revive it. And I'm like, you know, I can kind of see what you mean, because you're going to a big market. Yeah, like literally a dollar. I mean, it's crazy. Somehow we got Donald Trump on the podcast.
He took a whole lawsuit against the NFL and won, and was awarded $1, which bankrupted the entire league.
That's impressive. We should have
go against the NFL and win. And that's
it. Leading up to November, we should have Kamala Harris on the podcast to talk about her tenure living in Montreal and if she ever went to an Alouettes game. Then we should have Donald Trump on to talk about whether he thinks the CFL could work in New York, and base it off of the opinion of Brendan McGuire, our beloved contributor out of Regina. And we will use all of our energy to make sure that this happens. So stay tuned.
Long story short, I do think that United States expansion could work. And maybe we don't even need to get to 10 teams in Canada before we do that. But I think you got to go about it in the right way. And I don't think, with all due respect to the league office, that the CFL has gone about it the right way in Halifax. You go down to the United States, they ain't messing around down there. Okay? It'd be a much different feel. I'd be intrigued to see it. And I am willing to be supportive of anybody who would be open to putting their money into that kind of an investment.
I'm not entirely 100% opposed to US expansion, but I have several things that give me great pause about it. One of which is that I don't think Canadians have considered, and I fully agree that the CFL needs to get to 10 teams. I even think 12 would be a great number. I don't think more than 12 is really feasible, but at the end of the day,
let's start with that though. Okay, so let's say you had 10th team in Halifax, Hodge. Where would we?
Hold on.
Legitimately,
I don't want to hypothetically talk about Halifax, because yes, Halifax should be done, but it's no closer to happening now than it was 25 or 30 or even 40 years ago. So,
okay, so let's say we have optimally, 9. How would they get to 12?
Optimally, domestically, you'd probably go Halifax, Quebec City, London, Ontario. I don't think Quebec City will ever happen. I think Halifax could, if the stars align on a building and an owner. Mind you, that can be said about
London's every playing in the West.
Well, they're called Western at their school, so why wouldn't they play in the West? Like,
if you're
like
in London though, and you really want to be a fan of a CFL team, you could go to Hamilton. It's not that far away.
No, I know, but Southern Ontario has a huge population, and there's money in a lot of these burgeoning communities. So that's why I mention it. The issue with a place like Victoria is you're so close. I can't imagine the Lions would ever get behind that. Saskatoon's not going to happen because the Riders wouldn't let it happen. Brandon, Manitoba has like 40,000 farmers in it, and that's it. I can say that because I lived there for many years. That's not happening. So I think those are the only three. But here's the issue with going to the States, because people don't talk about this ever. There would be such a remarkable competitive imbalance that we would often see United States teams run roughshod over CFL teams. And let me demonstrate that really quick. I'm too young to remember the original U.S. expansion of the 90s, but I have read Ed Will's book about it multiple times. It's a great read if you haven't checked it out. The first thing that happened when they open things up to the United States is every top player who was a free agent signed down there. Why? Because why would you live in Canada as an American and pay double the taxes, right? You're paying Canadian taxes and American taxes when you can just live down south and pay American taxes, which, by the way, are lower when you're going to be, generally speaking, and be much closer to your family. Like Tracy Ham was already an MOP quarterback. What did he do? He signed in Baltimore. Matt Dunnigan signed in Birmingham. Why? Because he played his college ball at Louisiana Tech, which is not that far from Birmingham. It's certainly a hell of a lot closer than playing in Hamilton or Vancouver or Regina. Damon Allen went to Memphis. Alfred Payton, Hall of Fame pass rusher, went to Shreveport. Greg Battle went to Las Vegas. Like, we are going to lose a ton of talent from Canadian CFL teams to American CFL teams. Why? Because who could blame an American player for wanting to be closer to their family, for wanting to make more money, right? Because they're going to pay less in taxes and be in a better position to maybe even set themselves up for life after football, right? If they don't see themselves staying in Canada after they retire, maybe they can play 5 years, 6 years, 7 years for the same American CFL team and build a brand in a particular city, whether it's St. Louis, like you said. I know Austin, Texas gets talked about a lot because it's the biggest major American city without a professional sports team in the top four leagues. Or San Diego, right? A city that lost a CFL team. Like, I can't imagine.
CFL or NFL?
Pardon me, NFL team. Well, they've never had a CFL team, though they'd probably lose one if one went there. If you are an American free agent, how much more money does it take to get you to Regina, where it's going to be freezing cold for the last 2 months of the season, when you could sign in Austin, Texas, when you could sign in San Diego, when you could sign in St. Louis, and again, make more money there because you're taxed less and you're not taxed twice? Like, the competitive imbalance of the CFL will be destroyed if they expand to the United States. I fully believe that. It happened in the 90s. These were expansion teams. They only lasted like 1 or 2 years, and one of them went to 2 Grey Cups and won one. Imagine if the others had had competent coaching. Mm. Right? Like, that will happen if the CFL has American teams long term. Canadian teams will struggle to compete, and that problem will persist forever. It will not go away. So I just want people to think about that and acknowledge that and know that, because we know from the 90s there will be a massive talent drain south, and it would only happen worse. Like, Drew Brown was the top quarterback available. He's from Palo Alto, California. Granted, that's more north, like San Jose. But if there was a team in San Diego, do you think there's a chance in HE double hockey sticks? I'm not going to swear, Dunk. If there's any chance he signs in Ottawa, he can make more money living like a 7-hour drive north of his family. Can you even fly direct to Ottawa from California? I'm betting the answer is no.
I would think in this day and age you could.
Maybe. You could barely fly direct Winnipeg to Ottawa, much less whatever it be, San Jose, or whatever. You might fly to San Francisco. I don't know. All I'm saying is U.S. expansion will kill the competitiveness of CFL teams. And when the competitiveness of CFL teams goes down, you want to know what else is going to go down? Ticket sales and television ratings. You're hurting yourself. That's my take. And I think people need to think about that clearly before we talk about expansion of the U.S.
I have a lot of respect for Wally Buono, obviously, growing up here in BC when he was the head coach and GM, watching all the success that he had. But he's made a couple of crucial mistakes in his life, you know, recommending Chris Jones for the job in Edmonton this last time around probably comes to mind. And this is another one. It would be a terrible idea to put teams in the U.S. again. It was a terrible idea the first time around. Now, it was a necessity, right? Without U.S. expansion, the CFL might not have survived because of the expansion fees they got from those absolutely terrible U.S. owners. Amounted to about $15 million at a time when the league was dead broke. Those U.S. teams, for the record, in just 1995 alone, lost an estimated $20 million U.S. dollars combined. I don't know what Buono is talking about. Obviously, he played down, or he coached against U.S. teams. He had some fond experiences, it sounds like. But other than Baltimore, these teams were sparsely attended. Nobody else went over 20,000 in their stadiums. And even Baltimore lost about 7,000 fans on average from the first season to the second. And the interest dissipated overnight when the NFL came back, which is part of the reason they became the Montreal Alouettes. There is not an appetite for Canadian football south of the border. You're very limited in what cities it would even be moderately successful in, because you can't go into the football hotbed of the U.S. South, because A, when you're playing games in June, July, and August, it's way too hot to feasibly do that all the time outdoors. You're cooking an egg off the helmet. And then you get into major college football and even high school football seasons, which are a religion in some of those southern states. So the competition there is simply too fierce. And frankly, it doesn't really work in any other major cities unless they're temporarily aggrieved because the NFL has relocated their team. St. Louis potentially works, but even if you put a CFL team there momentarily, if they have any degree of success, that's going to be a flashing green light to any NFL owner that wants to relocate their current team to go straight to St. Louis because there's money to be made there. Or if the NFL ever wanted to expand and try and get to those 90 teams they should have per capita, Dunk, they'd see that as a prime opportunity too. And as soon as that happens, you're dead in the water as a smaller football league. Nothing that we've seen from any of the spring alternatives would suggest that there is a meaningful demand for more football year-round, particularly at a sub NFL level in the United States. It's a bad idea with massive logistical challenges in terms of none of the stadiums would be big enough for a CFL field. You have to make all sorts of concessions for that. You can't employ the ratio, which I think you're slightly overblown in terms of the competitive disadvantage, because so many of those American teams were absolute dog poop during American expansion. So it wouldn't have an immediate effect, but I think over time, you're correct, it would shift the balance of power if a franchise didn't have to use the ratio and could pull from the local pool of talent as effectively as a major U.S. city. So it's just bad across the board for the CFL. It should not even be considered. Focus on growing the brand at home. Focus on Halifax or Quebec City if you want to chase the dragon. Do it here to get to a 10th team. Don't even think about crossing the border, because once you do that for real, the way the CFL is now, which is stronger than it's ever been, you're only going to have a negative impact on this league.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You never know. I don't want to say it's for certain, but I think you guys raised some valid points. You know, some of the other things that come into this are the U.S. versus the American dollar. Mm. And how are those teams going to operate in the United States as it relates to the ratio with labor laws and all that kind of stuff. So there's lots to be figured out when you even just start to think about this conversation. It's one thing to say it in a vacuum and be like, oh, this would be a great idea. But when you start to go through it, as you guys have laid out, especially for the taxes, the money difference, the ratio, the labor laws, the talent, as Hodge mentioned, there is so many different little items that you have to think about and cross off your list. And, you know, JC is right. There's so much football down there. That spring league point, I think, is spot on. I don't want to categorize the CFL as whatever you said, JC, and maybe
sub NFL,
less than the NFL. Yeah, I don't think it's sub NFL because we've heard guys like Chad Ochocinco and seen Johnny Manziel struggle up here, and Christian Covington this year, you know, doesn't look great coming from a much heralded NFL. And I'm not saying that there aren't freaks down there that are absolute crazy ballers. But I think that that's kind of part of the problem with the CFL is it doesn't necessarily market itself, I think, as much as it could using some of those numbers about the stars that are here or the freaky level of athletes. Like Trevor Reed, rookie left tackle for the Riders. This guy can do like back spring hand flips over and over again for laying on his feet. Like crazy athletes up here. You know, I know Glenn Suter has said this a number of times. And I think it's something that warrants at least some consideration because if it was marketed more and the stars, I don't want to say were made to look sexy, but had their athletic attributes put out there to the general population in Canada more and even the US, then I think the league as a whole could earn itself a lot of respect. Winnipeg Blue Bombers linebacker Adam Big Hill drilled Saskatchewan Rough Riders QB Shea Patterson into the turf on the final play of Week 7's game between the two teams, which ended in a 19-9 win for the home side at Mosaic Stadium. The hit took place in front of Saskatchewan's bench, drawing pushing and shoving on the field and an outcry from Rider Nation on social media and on the call-in show. I know that firsthand. Hodge, was the hit clean?
The answer is yes and no, and I want to explain that. Because when you look at the CFL's rule book, as I did, there are seven different ways that a hit can be deemed roughing the passer. One of them, it's letter B, by the way, if you want to check out the rule book for yourself. It's on CFL.ca. Letter B, as it stands in the rule book, states contacting the passer in an unnecessary manner, including stuffing them to the ground, violently throwing them to the ground and landing on them with most of the defender's weight, close quote. That is considered roughing the passer. That is 100% what Adam Big Hill did. He drove Shea Patterson into the turf and used most of his body weight. The issue is this. This is never called in the CFL, which comes back a little bit to our officiating discussion we had earlier. If a rule is not enforced, it shouldn't be a rule. I don't know why this is a rule in the CFL. We see guys get planted all the time. Vernon Adams Jr. on Sunday took a hellacious hit from Brandon Dozier, absolutely crushed him in the ribs, landed right on his gut. This happens all the time. It's never called. The only things that are called roughing the passer are really three things. One, when a hit is late. Two, when it involves the helmet. Or three, when it's below the knee. Those are the only things that are called roughing the passer. And Adam Big Hill didn't do any of those things. So according to the letter of the law, it's roughing the passer. In practice, it's not roughing the passer, which is why I imagine it wasn't called roughing the passer on the field. The other thing I'll say is Corey Mace is on the record having no problem with the hit. Shea Patterson is on the record saying he has no problem with the hit. So if the head coach and the quarterback himself have no problem with the hit, I don't understand why anybody else does, especially considering that Shea Patterson was not hurt. Could Adam Big Hill have let up? Yes, of course. That is true of any player on any play. He didn't. Why? Because he is a Hall of Fame middle linebacker who gets paid to hit people. He saw someone he could legally hit. He hit him as hard as he could, technically against the rules, but a rule that is apparently never enforced. So I don't have a problem with it. I would call it a clean hit for that reason. Yeah, he didn't have to, but he could, and he did. And Corey Mace and Shea Patterson don't have a problem with it. I don't think anybody should have a problem with it.
Dunk, the next time you're on that call-in show and somebody phones up and wants to criticize me for my picks or take a shot at my dislike of some aspect of the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, tell them to keep crying, because this is ridiculous that Rider Nation is outraged about this. It's a football game. There's still time on the clock. The play is still live. Adam Big Hill is paid to hit people. And yes, I get that there is no way that the Winnipeg Blue Bombers could win that football game at that stage.
But that's not the only thing at play here. These games are not isolated to just 60 minutes. There's a three-game series that you've got to play against the Saskatchewan Roughriders. And if you lay a hit like that, maybe it puts a little hitch in Shea Patterson's giddy-up. He gets a little antsy the next time he sees Adam Big Hill coming downhill. It sends a message that impacts future games. Or maybe he still had the ball in his hands. It pops loose. They're able to recover and score points. One of those three games ends up being a tie, and you end up helping yourself in the point differential to give yourself a little aid in the playoffs. My point being, you don't know what's going to happen. You play every play until that play is over, and that play wasn't over because for some unknown reason, Shea Patterson decided to dance around out there for 10 seconds when he didn't need to and put himself in harm's way. Adam Big Hill was entirely justified in laying that hit the way he did. Was it excessive? Sure, but I don't know what that means in professional football. It's a contact sport. Nobody should have an issue with it. And if you don't want your quarterback getting hit at the end of the game with zeros on the clock, don't let him run around for 10 seconds with zeros on the clock. It was entirely on the Saskatchewan Roughriders, and I have no problem with what Adam Big Hill did.
You know, I was a part of a similar situation when I played the University of Guelph, but I won't tell the story, okay? I'll just give my opinion on this situation right here. I do actually think that when you look at that rule, you could argue that, yeah, a penalty flag should have been thrown. And I understand it from both perspectives, okay? I get why a JoJo, for example, is like, come on, bro. Come on, man. You don't have to do that. But on the other side, for as much as Rider Nation thinks Mike O'Shea was a dirty player and he seems to be okay with this hit, I can see where you're playing through the whistle, right? If Shea Patterson's trying to skip the pocket, it shouldn't matter if it's the first snap of the game or the last snap of the game. You're sending a message, and that's exactly what Patterson said. The most interesting part, though, of all this to me, fellas, is what would O'Shea say if this situation was reversed? If let's say that was Jameer Thurman planting Zach Collaris into the turf while running around, Bombers have the lead at Mosaic Stadium, or the pause they're calling it now, which I don't really like. But anyway, what would come out of O'Shea's mouth? Because I feel like the inconsistency over the years from coaches, and I understand you got to defend your guys, to me is always funny. We'll probably really never know, because I doubt a similar exact situation is going to happen for O'Shea to comment on. But to me, that is what kind of gets my interest with this stuff is, okay, you know, let's flip it around. And what if that was your quarterback getting planted to the turf? How would you feel? Hodge, how would you feel if that was your quarterback? JC, how would you feel if that was your quarterback?
I don't think that situation is ever going to play out in Winnipeg, because that would mean they would need to be leading by 10 points or more in the fourth quarter, which they apparently don't do anymore.
True.
So I don't know what he would say. I get it.
Trevor Harris's season ended last year, arguably, because Craig Dickinson put him in that situation. And you have it come up again. Like, can we not come up with a better play call? And yeah, I'm being critical of Mark Mueller, even though I think he's done a great job to start the season in Saskatchewan. So you don't put your quarterback in harm's way. Or you just say, hey, worst case scenario, you throw that ball away before anyone gets even close to you. And I'm assuming, yes, I'm saying assuming, I don't like doing that, but those were the instructions that he was given from Mueller and anybody else on the coaching staff that was talking to him through his headset. And full credit to Patterson, he was not upset about it. His demeanor has stayed the same throughout the ups and the down of the loss, and now another up of being a Saskatchewan Roughrider starting quarterback. But I will say, guys, even though Corey Mace said that it was just the usual post-game pleasantries with Mike O'Shea, it did not appear to be that way when they came off the field. Do you guys agree or disagree?
I fully agree. I don't believe it was the usual pregame stuff. And it wouldn't surprise me if Corey Mason, game. Mike O'Shea.
Postgame.
Postgame. It wouldn't surprise me if they had a phone call this week. The CFL coaching camaraderie is strong, right? These guys know each other. They talk to each other.
Fraternity.
Exactly. It is a fraternity. I think they're probably handling it privately. Osh is not one to take shots at other coaches in the media. Corey Mace has never done it. To my knowledge, though, he's only been a head coach for a third of a season at this point. So probably that conversation took place. And good for Corey Mace for handling it behind closed doors. But again, just as with any quarterback, we need to protect quarterbacks, but also quarterbacks need to protect themselves. Mm. You can't hold onto the ball. You can't do your best Michael Riley impression, right, and hold on to the ball for 10 seconds until someone is...
Mike Riley's out here like, bro, I'm just enjoying retirement. Literally
an inch away from you.
And take a sucker punch to the face?
And then get smashed.
Sheesh.
And then complain about it. Michael Riley never complained about it, but he did hold on to the ball for longer than anybody else I've ever seen in the CFL. You have to get rid of it and protect yourself. Then the refs can protect you. If you're not protecting yourselves... Nobody can protect you. You're going to get hit, and you're going to get hit hard.
Yeah. And perhaps you can speak better on this, Hodge, because you're there for every Winnipeg game. But to Rider Nation's point about, what if it was Zach Caleros? What would Mike O'Shea say then? I don't have any recollection of Mike O'Shea ever flying off the handle and calling another team dirty or doing something of that nature. He can be impassioned on certain topics, but typically – he keeps it to his own team.
Yeah, he's no.
And he would deflect a question of that nature. At least that's 100%. My assessment of it. So I don't think he would have a different stance if it was Caleros.
There was the game in Edmonton last year where Caleros was... And by the way, this is something else I'll say. I know we're running slow on this topic. We'll move on right away. But another thing I saw was people saying, well, of course it's a clean hit because Shea Patterson's not in the pocket, so he's treated like a runner. Just so that everyone's aware, the word pocket does not appear in the CFL's rulebook, and nowhere in the roughing the passer section does it discern any difference whatsoever about whether a player is in the pocket, out of the pocket, 30 yards behind the line of scrimmage, 1 yard behind the line of scrimmage. There is absolutely no difference on paper that I can find where it says anything about the location mattering for where a hit takes place. If there is one, please somebody tweet at me and point it out to me. I would love to learn about it if it is there. As far as I understand, it doesn't matter if you're in the pocket, beside the sideline, anything. A passer is a passer is a passer. There is no difference made. And I remember looking that up because last year, Zach Caleros was out of the pocket, took a headshot from Luches Purifoy as he threw a pick. Or no, Luches Purifoy made the pick. It might have been Noah Curtis who hit him. I can't remember. And I'm sure
it was Curtis. It was
somebody else hit him. No, Zach would probably be dead if he took a headshot from Jermaine Kelly. That's a big, big, big man. I don't know who it was, but regardless, yeah. He took a headshot, and I'm sure Osh was asked about it after the game. I'd have to go back and watch the video, but yes, I've been in enough of his pressers to know he's going to deflect it. He's not going to criticize officiating, and he's not going to criticize the other team. Even if you could see in his eyes, he's probably upset about it. Boys, this news is officially a week old, though we'd be remiss if we didn't discuss Chris Jones being fired by the Edmonton Elks. By the way, Edmonton Elks, shout out. Thank you so much for firing Chris Jones an hour after we finished recording our podcast. Definitely not upset about that at all. The 57-year-old finished his second go-around with the team at 8-33 and is 61-70 all-time as a CFL head coach. JC, was the firing warranted, and did the team get the timing right?
The firing was absolutely warranted. And no, they completely botched the timing of this. And frankly, I think it cost them two victories, potentially. Because you had a shot after 4 weeks, you're 0-4. It's clearly trending in the direction of Chris Jones being fired. It's been trending that direction for 2 years plus. And you've got a 17-day break between games. It's almost as if it should have come with a giant label on the schedule from the league with fire coach here, right? That's what it was there for. After four games, you can make the move. You got all the time in the world to install Jarius Jackson, get him to get everything set up properly, And then you can roll in with back-to-back games against Ottawa, which traditionally has not been that good of a team over the last little bit, and potentially right the ship with two quick wins because of that new coach bump. Instead, you don't fire Jones during that 17-day break. You go in. The cancerous presence continues. You lose another close football game against Ottawa. And then on a short week, as we've already talked about, then you fire the coach and you put in Jarius Jackson. So he's got like 3 days at that point to figure everything out and install his plan and somehow try and coach a victory against the same Red Blacks that just ripped your heart out. It made no sense. It put that entire team in a terrible situation. And it's no wonder that they didn't receive that usual boost of energy that you get after firing a head coach where everyone snaps to attention and tries to rally around the new guy, because they simply didn't have time to. They're beat up. They're confused. They're on a difficult week anyway. And Edmonton just botched this from the top down, from the hiring of Chris Jones to everything to do with his contract that gave him 2 years of ineptitude to the way he was fired this year. It has been a complete and utter disaster from this organization.
The Elks are fully Elksing. And this is all I'll say about Chris Jones. Karma, if you know, you know.
I think that's well said, boys. And I echo JC's sentiments. I was told before the season that if this team started 1-3 or 0-4, that Chris Jones would be gone at the bye. I reiterated that on the show. And then lo and behold, he survived the bye week. And it turns out that Chris Jones is not a cockroach or a Twinkie. He is, in fact, fallible. He will not survive the apocalypse. He finally got fired after game five. And it's easy to see why, right? This was a mess. I also had a source indicate that even before the firing, Chris Jones may or may not have been calling to high schools in the States looking for a potential job, which we know
probably
he
did.
Probably
for his dream job, right?
Of course, the dream job that he had and then left not long afterwards in his hometown after leaving the Cleveland Browns following the 2021 season. We'll see. I don't know if we're going to see Chris Jones back at the CFL. I don't think it's impossible to think, because we do have a number of people in this league who still love Chris Jones, right? Who go back with him 20 years, 25 years, who are head coaches or people of influence who could potentially bring him back as a DC or something, but maybe we have seen the last of Chris Jones. Who knows? Regardless, Edmonton, I agree.
Were his defenses recently, though, even any good?
No, they weren't. Not
but
recently,
you,
no.
You can't let them shop for the groceries, right? That's my problem.
It doesn't matter, man. Right?
1,000%.
Like, his defense, when he
did,
took over...
His defenses were bad.
When he took over midseason for Toronto, was that 2021? When was that?
It was 2021.
2021. Like, he wasn't terrible.
Let me say it this way, Dunk.
It wasn't great, though.
It's irrelevant how good the defenses were, because you and I both know that some coaches have just gotten hired because they're buddies with people and not necessarily because of the work they've done. That's not how it should work. That's not how it should work. Okay. Unfortunately, it is how it works sometimes. We'll now go on to Hodge's heritage moment. On this day in 2018, Johnny Manziel was traded to the Montreal Alouettes alongside Tony Washington and Landon Rice in exchange for Jamal Westerman, Chris Williams, and two first-round draft picks. The former Heisman Trophy winner would throw four interceptions in his first career start with the Alouettes and was eventually banned from the CFL for violating the agreement that he made eligible to play in the league. Dunk, how vividly do you remember this day?
Bro, I'll never forget it, because I had the news on the trade. I was at CHCH preparing to do my 6 p.m. sports cast. And I was obviously doing stuff for Sportsnet and still sometimes do. And they figured out a way to patch me through from the CHCH newsroom to Sportsnet, because it was that big that Sportsnet actually cared about it, to do a report or whatever you want to call it, segment about it on Sportsnet Central. So I'll never forget it, but I actually won't forget even more where I was when I first heard about it. And I was so surprised. I think it was either a day or two before, and I was out by my family's farm. I was supposed to say the road, but I won't say it in case there's any weirdos out there. and I was in the basement. I was like, is my reception right? Like, is this actually real? Because it was Johnny Manziel and then all of the stuff you listed there that was the return coming back the other way. I'm like, this can't be possible. Like, is this real? It's one of those things where you get the news and you're kind of like, this seems so far-fetched that it doesn't seem real. But sure enough, it was.
I know that the elements of the trade were very much in flux, even like to the day it was done. Like, there were players involved in that trade, I was led to believe, hours before it was done, who didn't end up getting flipped, which is wild. One of them, I believe, was Tyler Johnstone, the Canadian tackle who played at Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
That's right.
Yeah. It was wild for me, all the pieces with the draft picks, right? Like, for years afterwards, we're talking about the Montreal Alouettes not having any proper draft capital in the first round because of the Manziel trade, and they lost out on some very good players as a result of that. Coulter Woodmansey, of course, the starting guard for the Hamilton Tiger Cats right now. He was a player that was acquired with one of those draft picks. Now, Montreal didn't necessarily lose out entirely because Tony Washington and Landon Rice turned out to be a couple of very good tackles for them. But certainly I think the loss of their first round picks hurt them for that dark patch they went through.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the other guys. Frankly, I don't want to talk about Johnny Manziel ever again under any circumstances. I'm so Johnny Manziel sick and tired of that. But something wild is the Alouettes actually cut Landon Rice like a month after trading for him. He immediately signed back with the Ticats, which made the trade look even worse because one of the pieces Montreal got immediately went back to Steeltown. Then in 2019, Landon Rice signs, not even immediately, like partway through the season with Montreal. And then he goes on to become an all-star right tackle. Like, he didn't make an all-star roster until he was 33 years old. And he did it twice.
He went back to the Ticats that year.
Yeah, like Landon Rice was for all intents and purposes considered a bust. And then he becomes an all-star ratio-breaking tackle, which is wild. Which is why sometimes we have to be more patient with players. Because it's interesting, right? When you look at Tony Washington, who was a very good left tackle for them for 3 years, Landon Rice, who's a very good right tackle for Alouettes for all those years, in a way that the Alouettes kind of made out in this deal. Like, we think of it as this crazy one-sided thing, but like, Jamal Westerman was done. He did nothing in Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Chris Williams was done. He did nothing in Hamilton. They played 12 games combined. Like, really, they didn't get anything. Both, don't get me wrong, amazing players, but just were obviously past their prime. So the Alouettes, I don't know, in a way, like, Manziel was a bust. They cut Landon Rice, but in a weird way, they kind of made out okay. It's weird.
Let's go to the 3-minute drill, boys. The Edmonton Elks named Almando Sewell their new defensive line coach following Nate O'Neill's resignation. Is that a great hire?
I do. I was led to believe that Nate O'Neill actually resigned before Chris Jones' last game, but it's unclear why or exactly what that timeline was. Regardless, Almando probably should have been the D-line coach from the beginning. You can't ask for a better guy who knows that team, knows that culture, and who knows how to play D-line in this league, get the best out of guys. I think it's a great move. The Toronto Argonauts signed veteran defensive lineman Woody Barron. Could the former BC Lion help their pass rush?
I think he can, right? The Lions moved on from Barron because they wanted to get a little bit bigger in the middle, help stop the run, which they've had trouble with the last number of years. But he's been an excellent interior pass rusher and was last season. The Argos already have the pieces to stop the run. They've got some great ones like Jared Brinkman there, although he was hurt this week. If Woody Barron comes in and he can just get after it, create some penetration in the middle, I think that's highly valuable. Jamarcus Hardrick will likely miss the rest of the season after suffering a torn quad. How big of a loss is that for the Riders?
It's definitely a big one, but Jacob Brammer did pretty well in his first career CFL start at right tackle. He's definitely not Hardrick, but Willie Jefferson is a difficult test, and I felt like he played as if he belonged in the CFL, still needs to prove that he can do it game in and game out for the duration of a season. But after one game, the kid looks pretty good. He's not Hardrick, but the Riders might be okay. And they're starting two rookie tackles, by the way, Trevor Reed on the other side. The Ottawa Redblacks have released former first-round pick Deshaun Stevens. Is that a surprise?
It's not, because Stevens really didn't do anything in three seasons with the Redblacks, which is too bad, because Deshaun Stevens was a nightmare at the University of Maine in 2018 as a redshirt sophomore. Unfortunately, he tore his Achilles the following year. I'm not convinced he's ever been the same player, which is really too bad. Hopefully, he can find the right fit and have somewhat of a renaissance, but he has not lived up to the billing of a first-round pick. The Montreal Alouettes have signed Canadian receiver Nate Behar. Can he help them improve their passing game?
I'm not sure about improve, because they've got some really nice pieces in that Alouettes passing game, but he can help them right now survive through some injuries. Kayon Julian Grant, it sounds like, is going to be out for a while. Behar is somebody who can step right in as that Canadian receiver and be a very competent and capable starter for you while you wait for some of your stars to get back. Corey Mace said Trevor Harris is progressing extremely well from his left MCL sprain. Dunk, when will we see the veteran QB back in action for the Riders?
There's some factors at play here, and real quickly, because that's what it's supposed to be in the three-minute drill. You know, I think there's different ways they could play it. They could have him on there for the full six games and then come back for the Alouettes' home game, which is in mid-August. Especially with the way Shea Patterson is playing, you know, he's definitely not going to be back this week for the game in Montreal against the Elks. The week after, the Riders have a home game against the Edmonton Elks, who we talked about a bunch on this show. They're atrocious. So if you let Shea Patterson get a little bit more playing time, if you're the Riders, are you looking at the situation like, hey, is this guy playing himself into potentially being our franchise quarterback? Because the one thing that has been talked about a lot here, Trevor Harris's contract is up at the end of this current season, fellas. So do you want to see a little bit more of Shea Patterson before you put Trevor Harris in there? And then there's the way crazy deep end of this, where Rider fans are already calling into post-game shows and posting on social media that Shea Patterson's better than Trevor Harris. Newsflash. That ain't the case right now, but Patterson certainly has shown a great progression and intriguing upside. The Alouettes aren't ruling out Cody Fajardo for their Week 8 game against the Riders due to a hamstring injury. Hodge, do you think he'll play, or is this just gamesmanship?
I don't think he's going to play. That is speculation, but we know that the Montreal Alouettes were careful with Cody Fajardo when he got hurt last year. Total coincidence, but the first game he missed last season, Caleb Evans started 2-1 in both, was at home against Saskatchewan. The Alouettes won that game 41-12. I don't think they're going to be able to repeat that performance this year. The Riders seem much improved, especially on the defensive side of the ball. But there's no reason at 5-1 and far and away atop the East Division standings for the Alouettes to risk bringing Cody Fajardo back too soon. To me, it's a pretty easy decision. Sit him until he's 100%. If you lose a random game in July because of it, that's not going to hurt you come November. Be smart. Play Caleb Evans. Let Cody Fajardo get back to 100%. Just like you did last year. It worked out pretty well. Last I recall, you won the Grey Cup. TJ Lee made his 2024 debut with the BC Lions, coming back from months ahead of schedule from an Achilles tear. What did you think of his debut?
I think he looked exactly like he's always looked, which is an elite halfback in the CFL. Truly a remarkable comeback. 33 years of age, TJ Lee returns 3 months ahead of schedule from that torn Achilles, which could be career-ending for a player of that age. You know, he gets beat on the one touchdown by Jalen Philpott, which wasn't his fault in that game. It was an absolutely insane play and great coverage by the Canadian receiver, but makes as good a defensive play as you'll ever see when he tackles Mark and Michelle at the goal line, fighting through a little pick there to get there just in time for the turnover on downs later in that game. I think he's going to be just as good as ever after being an all-star for the second time in his career last season. The Stampeders and Blue Bombers drew almost 650,000 viewers on TSN during their Week 6 matchup at Princess Auto Stadium. Why was the number so high?
Some factors that I believe led to this. Primetime game on a Friday night. Copa America was finished, or at least Canada wasn't playing. NHL playoffs were done. The NBA playoffs. CFL kind of has this little stretch here to themselves, but that's going to change a little bit with the Olympics in Paris set to start as we move into week eight here, But the other major factor was that game was unbelievable. Back and forth, Jake Mayer, Zach Collaros, touchdowns going everywhere, 41-37 barn burner. That certainly helped the growing audience throughout the game.
Lastly, we want to acknowledge the passing of Peter Martin at the age of 83. He passed away after a courageous battle with kidney cancer, according to his obituary, which was shared with permission to Mike Hogan, who does comms for the Toronto Argonauts, among other things. Peter was a player for the Argos at linebacker for seven seasons, eventually became a very influential coach in the Mississauga area, and also called Argos games on radio for them for over a quarter century, among other jobs, being involved with the CFL Alumni Association, the Toronto Argonauts Alumni Association, like a real cornerstone in that organization. He was recently inducted into the all-time Argos list, which is fantastic that he got that opportunity before passing. So we wish the very best to his family and friends following his passing this past weekend. We'll see you next week for our next episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.